Hello, and welcome to Pro EFT Radio with Lindsey Kinney, EFT Master. Hello, and welcome to Pro EFT Radio with Lindsey Kinney, EFT Master. If you're new to EFT, please visit us at proeft.com after the show to familiarize yourself with meridian tapping. It's important to learn the basics of EFT in order to get the most out of the material we'll be covering in these programs. You'll find a wealth of free resources at proeft.com, including a free starter program that will help you build on a solid foundation for tapping. Now here's Lindsey.
Well, good evening, everybody. This is Lindsey Kinney, and I'm really pleased and proud tonight to have as our guest Catherine Taylor. Catherine is a good friend of mine, a client, a student, a friend. Our dogs are engaged to be married, which is a problem because both of them are males, but then nothing's wrong. We don't think anything's wrong with that. And, Catherine, isn't that true?
Yes, it is.
And so I know it's kind of an unusual situation. We'll be sisters-in-law, mothers-in-law or something. Anyway, Catherine is a certified pro EFT practitioner and a licensed marriage and family therapist. And her specialty is addiction. She's an addiction counselor and is the author of several books, five books, including the bestseller, Inner Child Work, Inner, I-N-N-E-R, Child Work. It's really great, and her techniques go really well with the bundling baggage technique. So tonight, Catherine's going to talk to us about interactive tapping as a way to develop self-soothing voices that are needed to quiet the addict within all of us. Now, you know, I might take umbrage with that I'm not an addict, but I think you'll see that we all have tendencies to be addicted to something. Okay, chocolate maybe. Catherine's got some really interesting tools to use, of tapping of which is the foremost. But you can find Catherine's material and how to contact her and information about her new 30-day program about for the recovery for addicts and that www.joincatherinetaylor.com. Now, Catherine is spelled, if you've seen her bio on our website, differently. It's C-A-T-H-R-Y-N-C-A. THRYNTaylor.com. Join CatherineTaylor.com. So, Catherine, say hi to everybody.
Well, thank you, and hello, everybody. I'm excited to talk about this subject. It's one that's very dear to my heart.
Well, it's a big one, addiction. We probably all have had some addiction or something at one time or another, even a small one like addiction to food or caffeine, smoking, porn, chocolate, something. And, you know, a lot of us have clients and friends, family members that have had addiction problems. So like cancer, it, in many ways they are similar. Mm-hmm. We all deal with it in our lives at some point or another. So tell us how you deal with addictions. How are your, what do you do?
Well, first of all, the way I look at addiction is I look at addiction as anything that keeps us from living our lives in a fulfilling way, and yet we continue to do so despite our desire to not do so. So it's one of those behaviors that keeps getting in the way and sabotaging us from getting what we want. Now, there's so many different layers of addiction, and with all of the biochemical information that's coming out now, we're gathering more and more information about all of our allergies. I mean, addiction, like alcoholism, that's all it is an allergy. Huh. And it's the same kind of allergy as when someone has diabetes or has an addiction to sugar, is that it's just gone in terms of the liquid form of sugar instead of the food version. And so I look at it as anything that becomes a habit and becomes a behavior that we don't want to engage in, but we find ourselves repeatedly engaging in it anyway. So there's a loss of control.
Hmm. Well, when you say an allergy, I have clients that are addicted to organic things. Like one's addicted to, several men I've dealt with that are addicted to internet porn, and one that's addicted to solitaire. He cannot get his work done. He functions at a very high level, but he just is addicted to solitaire. Mm-hmm. And are those are allergy-based addictions as well?
Well, those are called process addictions. And what they've come to find out, most of the studies have been done on gambling, but what they've come to find out, and Candace Pert has actually done a lot of work on this, is is that the gambling addict or the sex addict or the porn addict, they get addicted to that adrenaline rush in the same way that an alcoholic gets addicted to something that they ingest. Mm. The codependent gets addicted to that adrenaline rush that they get when they have to deal with the crisis of another person. So that's where all of the new studies on the biochemical perspective are really coming in and showing how all of these behaviors are affecting our biochemistry, and we in effect get addicted not only to substances that we ingest, but to the adrenaline and all the neurotransmitters and all those things that I really can't even speak to because I it's beyond my training, but it's still, we're getting addicted to it, and it's cueing us in the same way that an alcoholic gets cued to have a drink.
Oh, well, that's interesting. So do you primarily deal with people who have these hardcore addictions, or you deal with them once they're in recovery?
Well, I've dealt with them from every angle. Since 1985, I've worked in some form of treatment facility. So I've worked in inpatient and outpatient, and I've run a whole outpatient program for 3 years. And then in my private practice, I deal with more of what I call the second stage recovery. Most of my work is really based on the Inner Child Workbook that was published in 91. And that was an outgrowth of a class that I actually started in 1986 at the College of Marin. Oh. And I taught that every quarter there for 6 years. And in that class is when I really developed my flow chart that identified the three cycles that led to addiction and then the three cycles of recovery. And so the intervention stage is what I'm really dealing with when I'm working with somebody in treatment. And when they've gone through treatment and they've arrested the disease and they are learning some new coping mechanisms, then about 18 months into it, when they're really solid in intervening in the behavior, is when they can begin to look at some of the deeper issues, the childhood issues, without risking their relapse. Now, that's gotten a little more gray in the last years because what they're finding, especially with women and especially with dual diagnosis, is that the old adage where you didn't touch any emotional stuff until, you know, you were solid in a recovery program and all of that, that's really changing because what they're finding is 75% of women alcoholics come from an abusive situation. And so they get into treatment, and they can't stay sober because the feelings about the abuse come up, and it takes them back out. Mm-hmm. And so that's what kind of led the whole mental health community and addiction community into pairing up and coming up with the dual diagnosis category.
Well, what does that mean, dual diagnosis?
It means that they have been identified as alcoholic, which they have the alcoholic disease, not just the habit of addiction, but they are biochemically addicted to alcohol the same way a diabetic would be addicted to sugar. Mm. And they have depression or anxiety disorder. So they've got a psychiatric disorder as well. And both have to be treated.
All right. So we heard that about people being that alcoholism is a disease, a sickness, not just a social problem. What about other addictions, smoking or gambling or those sort of things? Are those diseases as well?
Well, those haven't made it into that same category because they don't have the same physiological progressions. But again, I think the jury's still out on all of that because I think what we're going to begin to see is that a lot of our reactions are biochemically induced because of the breakdown in our immune system. And so that's why we're seeing so much more of the allergies and those desires to eat foods that we get real cravings for. I mean, like I have an allergy towards cheese. So I start eating cheese, and an hour later, the whole 8-ounce chunk is gone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
you know, it's that type of deal. Now, I'm not going to wake up, you know, the next morning in bed with somebody and not know their name because I ate 16 ounces of cheese, you know.
Yeah.
Worst is going to happen to me is I'm going to be a little constipated. So the consequences are different. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Alcohol and mood-altering chemicals are in a different category because they alter the way you think. They create blackouts.
Right, and you're dealing with somebody else. You can't. Everybody knows it's dealt with an addict of some kind. When they're high on drugs or alcohol, whatever it might be, you can't reason with them.
Oh, right.
And
right.
It's, Jack says it's easier to reason with. In a different category, my husband says, it's like the difference between a woman with PMS and a terrorist is that you can reason with a terrorist. And it's
yeah,
a little bit
exactly.
like that with an alcoholic, too. You,
yeah.
know, you could reason with a terrorist because you're not dealing with the person but a chemical version of,
mm-hmm.
of the person. So, Catherine, one of the things that's up all the time, especially right now, if you turn on the TV, you can't help but hear Charlie Sheen going, duh, winning,
right.
and
mm-hmm.
Lindsay Lohan and these celebrities
mm-hmm.
are in and out of rehab. It's almost like they wear as a badge of honor how many times they've been in and out of rehab, like nothing works
mm-hmm.
for me, you know, I'm
mm-hmm.
special, I'm different, and I can handle it, you know, it's
mm-hmm.
okay.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
how what's going on with those people that they're not, they're going to these high-quality, expensive rehab centers, and they're not getting helped?
Well, because you're dealing with the addict. And the only difference between them and the guy that I work with, you know, in my treatment center, is that they're famous and they get the publicity.
Right.
You know, but I'm sitting there with the same type of dynamic where when somebody's high, they will sell their mother
mm-hmm.
in order to get that next fix.
Yeah.
There's just, you know, I ran a meth clinic, and methamphetamine clinic, and I learned two things during that whole process. One is that once a meth addict got into recovery, there was a whole different creed of honor. For one, people on the street that found out that somebody that they had been using with got into treatment, the word was, at least this is true here, you leave him alone, he made it.
Oh, that's, well,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
nice.
But... yeah, yeah. You know, you don't mess with him because they knew how deadly it was
yeah.
and how easy it was to go back out. And some of the stories of what they would do, it was just heartbreaking. You know, and I worked with the families and helping them rebuild the trust, you know, and begin to see that, look, that wasn't the same person. You know, I know the impact of their addiction was very wounding, but what you need to understand is that was not their intention. That was not your son. That was not your husband. And yet you have to deal with your feelings. There's a parallel progression of recovery. And so both parties, by the time addiction has really taken them down, when they come into recovery, it's really by that time a family disease. And I call it the parallel recovery process because whoever has been assisting the addict in not dealing with their life, that person's worn out, resentful. They've been dealing with all of their empty threats, just like the addict has been dealing with all the broken promises.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so both have to step away from each other and not try to deal with the relationship too soon because they both are just depleted and they both need to work on their own programs and replenish themselves before they even know what they have to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So I really kept them apart when I worked in treatment with them.
Well, one of the things, I have so many questions for you. I worked for several years with a drug and alcohol rehab center here in my county for women. And it started with maybe the classes. I would go in every week to a class, and there were six or eight women in the first few. And then a few months later, there were 12 and 14, and then 20, and then 30, 40, 60. And it just grew by the end of a two-year period. The classes were four times the size, many of the same faces coming back.
Right.
And I couldn't do much with them in the time that we had, you know, toward addiction. So I worked on one thing with them, and that was their incredible shame and guilt. They were dried out by the time I got to them. At least they hadn't, you know, they had been weaned off of the stuff, and they were in the recovery somewhat. But their shame and guilt and disappointment in themselves and anger at themselves, resentment sometimes at people that had enabled them, but their anger and hatred toward themselves was profound.
Right.
And
that's self-loathing.
That was that self-loathing, right? That was something that I could you can deal with right away with tapping, with helping get over that. Do you face that?
Yes, and I absolutely agree. When I was running this program over here and I was using tapping, what we would do is tap on the establishing the relationship. This is where the interactive tapping comes in that we've talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
Building the interaction between the recovering self and the addict self. And I helped them begin to see that all of that behavior that they're so ashamed of is the behavior that they exhibited when they were under the influence, and that was the addict.
Mm-hmm.
And what recovery is really about, and you can only achieve this if you're abstaining. That's why it's so important to get somebody into an environment where they've got the support to abstain, because if they're not abstaining, then they can't begin to create that separation between the person that they are in their heart, the recovering part of self, the part of self who wants to get better, the part of self who really doesn't want to act in this way, and the addict who hijacks their brain and takes them out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd be in treatment, and I'd be working with somebody, and I could just feel when the addict, you know, personality came back in and started getting cocky and stuff, and I would address it like that, you know, and I'd say, okay, that's your addict. Can you see how your addict is starting to build a case here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, this is stupid. I don't want to do this tapping. I don't want to do this. And your addict's going to set it up so that she can get you back to that bar because this is stupid. You know, and then they'd be laughing. Okay, so let's tap about the recovering self because I really believe that you want to be here. So let's reinforce that. So a part of it as the facilitator is giving voice and seeing that part of them that really wants to hang in there.
Yeah, I think it's the layperson, a person who hasn't dealt with an addiction personally themselves, doesn't get the pull that it has. It's not the same as having a craving for chocolate. You know, it is so strong that it's not that it overcomes any will or desire. And so when you say, okay, I'm not going to have a drink today, and you just try to do it on your own, it's too powerful. There's not many people that can just go cold turkey themselves with some kind of a hard addiction. So then they hate themselves even more. They make these promises, I'm not going to do it. And then pretty soon they just give up because they know they're just going to disappoint themselves day after day after day.
Right, right. Well, and they become a dry drunk is what they become.
Yeah.
Really, you know, I mean, they are not medicating their anger. And so a lot of families say, you know, I liked him better when he was drinking.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, you know. That. So if they're not getting recovery and getting treated for those emotions, then they've got all that tension built up. But you know where I found tapping really, really effective is to help them tap through the trigger and for them to realize that I can have a choice. If I tap, a trigger only lasts for, at the most, 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So all you have to do, I'd say, all you have to do is just tap and say, you know, even though I really want to go out, I'm going to choose not to, even though I just don't want to do that. And I said, you know, don't worry about what you're saying. Just say whatever you are. Be as desperate as you need to be, but just be tapping. And you're going to feel a shift. And every time you feel that shift, you take one more step towards recovery, and you're going to have more faith in yourself. So the next time you have the trigger, because, you know, they come and go. As, you know, the body feels the need for it, and it develops the craving. You're going to have more confidence to do it again. And, boy, some of it really took to it like, you know, duck takes to water. Some of them I could never get them to do it.
Yeah, if they wait too long to the trigger, if they wait till the craving or the desire is five or six, it's too late. They go, screw it, I'd rather have the thing. I'd rather feed my urge.
Right.
You know, I use a little technique I'll share with you. I think I taught this in your level three. I'm not sure, Catherine, but the Dan Rather technique.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
If you establish why they want to be sober, how they would feel if they were clean and sober, whatever their addiction is, different, and they would feel good about themselves, empowered, confident, honoring their health, their family and commitments, whatever their things are that they want to go toward, you use those as a pulling thing to pull toward
it.
So you tap, and the Dan Rather comes from, even though I'd rather... even though I'd like to go out and get drunk, or I'd like to get a fix or whatever their addiction is, even though I'd like to do that, I'd rather honor my health and my family and my commitment to sobriety than screw up and feed this urge right now and then hate myself later for what I do.
Right.
And do that for a tapping, even though I'd like to do this, I'd rather do the good thing, make a better choice, than get into this urge and then hate my guts and have my family hate me. So let's do some tapping on how you do it, and I'll be your echo. Would you be comfortable doing that?
Absolutely. Now, because you just went through that, which is one way we could tap, I'm going to bring in a little different angle.
Sure, I want you to.
Okay, so the angle that I would use after I've taken them through what you just took them through, then I would introduce them to the concept that, again, you've got the recovering self, the part of you who's sitting here in treatment and comes here every night, and the addict in within you who's going to get scared and wants to go out. So now we're going to tap, and we're going to build a relationship between those two.
Mm-hmm.
So the setup would go like this. Even though...
All right, so I'm going to be your echo, and I'm going to urge everybody, since they're muted, I want to urge everybody to tap along with us. Will you do the points as you go, Catherine?
Absolutely.
If you guys don't know the points, you can find them on my website or on the media page. They're all over my website at proeft.com. But Catherine will just mention them, and so...
Okay, so since I'm with your community, I'm going to use the ones that I learned in your class.
Please.
Usually I just use the basic ones because I never know who I'm listening to, but I'll use the ones that I use in my work.
Okay, good.
All right, but we'll start with, I'm not going to do a reversal right now, even though one would be appropriate, but I just want to get into this. So
we're
just going to tap on the karate point, and we're establishing the relationship between the recovering self and the addict.
Okay.
So
even though I
really am committed to this recovery.
I'm really committed to this recovery.
And I realize how big of a step this was for me to get into treatment.
And I realize what a big step it was for me to get into the treatment.
Right now, I have this voice within me.
Right now, I have this voice within me.
That addict within me.
That addict within me.
And she really just wants to go and hit the bar.
She really wants to go and get a margarita.
So even though I'm committed to being here.
Even though I'm committed to being here, kind of.
Right now, I have such a big part of me.
Right now, I have such a big part of me.
Who really wants to go out.
Who really wants to go out.
I can barely stand it.
I can barely stand it.
And I'm just not sure what to do.
I'm just not sure what to do.
Okay, so now we're just going to neutralize that for the first sequence. So start on the eyebrow point.
Okay.
And we're going to give voice to the addict so that we neutralize that.
Okay.
I really want to go to that bar.
I really want to go to that bar.
Side of it. You're getting into this a little too much. I'm going to have to get Mackie out there. Side of the eye. God, I want a drink.
God, I want a drink.
Under the eye. I can't believe I'm stuck in this treatment center.
I can't believe I'm stuck in this stinky, boring treatment center on these hard metal chairs.
Upper lip. I really, really just want a drink.
I really, really want a drink.
Under the lip. I am so exhausted.
I'm so exhausted.
Collarbone, I'm so scared.
I'm so scared.
Under the arm, I can't deal with this.
I can't deal with this.
Rib, I can't be sober.
I can't be sober.
Wrist, I want to go out.
I want to go out.
Top of the head, I really, really want to go out.
I really want to get out of here.
Okay, now I have them switch. So we've given that voice. Now I'm going to bring out their recovery self, and I invite them, okay, now we're going to speak from the part of you who really does want to be here.
Okay.
Okay. So even though I know you want to go to the bar.
Okay. Now we're back on the karate chop, and we're speaking in second person.
In second person. We're speaking now to the addict.
Okay. Even though I know you want to really go to the bar.
And I really understand that.
And I really understand that.
Because we've spent so many years doing that.
Because we've spent so many years doing that.
But I'm really sick and tired.
I'm really sick and tired.
Of being sick and tired.
Of being sick and tired and drunk.
And I want to help you and I get better.
And I want to help you and I get better.
And I'm going to do it right now.
I'm going to do that right now.
Okay, so now start on the eyebrow point.
Okay.
I know you're really scared.
I know you're really scared.
Side of the eye. I'm scared too.
I'm scared too.
Under the eye. But I want us to get better.
I want us to get better.
Upper lip. I want my commitment to recovery.
I want my commitment to recovery.
Under the lip. To be stronger than your fear.
To be stronger than your fear.
Collarbone. I really want to help us get well.
I want to help us get well.
Under the arm. We've wasted too much of our lives.
We've wasted way too much of our lives.
Rib. So I know that you're cued to go back out there.
I know that you're cued up to go back out there.
Wrist. But I'm committed for us to learn something new. Top of the head. And this is a place that we can begin to do that.
And this is a safe place where we can do that.
So you get the feel for it. Obviously, it goes on for a lot longer than that.
I like that.
Yeah, it really begins to empower them to say, you know, I really deserve this recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do want something different. And this part of me is just my scared part of me. So it begins to build a bridge away from the self-loathing and into the self-soothing talk.
And I like that because you and I both know we talk in our workshops about the two sides of our conscious
right.
and subconscious, and you're talking to the addict and the one that wants to be sober. And so when they have a conversation together like that, it's almost like when somebody who cares about them, there's no one who knows the drunk inside of us like the sober guy who's
absolutely
really pulling and really wants us to get it together. And so when they're talking to each other like that in this honest, loving way, I can see that it's almost like you become your own friend and own cheerleader.
Right. You become your own healer.
Yeah, I really like that, Catherine. That's really, that's very powerful.
Well, you know, I had a beautiful experience with a friend of mine who really deals with this continuous addiction to sugar, and she gets off of it, and then she has been dealing with Parkinson's, and so she takes her medication, and that triggers the craving all over again, so she's right back out there. But we did this piece of work the other day, and before we were talking, and I've known this woman for 30 years, and this story has never come up, and she finally, you know, we were talking about, okay, what's some examples of your empowered self? Well, you know, I remember a time when I was walking to work, you know, blah, 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 and this man pulled off the road, and he jumped out of the car and held a knife to my neck and was going to rape me. And she said, and I stood up to him, and I talked him out of it.
Mm,
and I said, okay, that's who your addict and your little girl is waiting to come in and rescue her.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
So then we did this whole sequence where I'm finally ready to come and protect you.
Okay.
We don't have to eat the sugar. I'm ready to make you feel safe. And we were both crying by the end of it. It was so powerful. But that's what we need to do, is really find those mentors. Like, a lot of times I'll have people say, you know, who would you bring in? Like, one of them I bring in is Tina Turner.
Oh, really?
You know? And Tina Turner, I mean, she kicks, you know, she kicks it where it needs to be kicked when I need a strong kind of essence to work with one of my, what I call, cherished saboteurs.
What is that? What's a cherished saboteur?
Well, the cherished saboteur is the part of us who is really, really working night and day to keep us safe. And the reason I call it cherished, and it's not cherry, but cherished, like I cherish you, is because this part is so loyal to trying to distract us and trying to do whatever it needs to do, and it's the one that gets blamed.
Now, you're saying it's trying to, you're saying it's trying to keep us safe. It's the one that's trying to stay sober,
right?
The cherished saboteur?
No, the cherished saboteur is the one who acts out because it's impression that it keeps us safe by keeping us away from the pain and medicating the pain.
Oh, I see. Oh. Okay.
So the cherished saboteur is usually an inner child who learned at a very early age that it wasn't safe. And so they've been working overtime ever since with what I call the default coping mechanism. And that's our knee-jerk reaction to jet away from the pain, and our addictions serve to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we see this on TV and in the media all the time, where somebody hears some bad news or is reminded of something sad that's happened to them, and the first thing they do is they turn to the bottle.
Right.
Or the pill or whatever. They
right.
want to just escape instead of facing it or tapping on it or whatever it is. And
right.
we start learning that at a pretty young age, and often with our parents.
Right.
speaking of which, Catherine, what is, you mentioned something about the essential wound, the essential wound. Can you explain what that is?
Yes, the essential wound is really the first experience that we had when we realized the world was not safe. And then what we do is we begin to gather experiences that prove that. And at that moment of time, we establish what I call that default coping mechanism, which basically is our blueprint for surviving. It's based on the belief system that we made at the time and the emotions that accompany that belief system. So what occurs is that every time we have any kind of experience that resonates with that essential wound, let's say it's an abandonment, and then for the next 35 years, every time we experience abandonment, we go into that knee-jerk reaction, and we operate in that same way to keep ourselves safe. Well, over a period of time, our system finally wears out, and that's when our psyche or our body creates a symptom. And so then that's where we'll see that precipitating event before somebody gets the diagnosis of cancer or depression, or they develop addiction, or they start going on anti-anxiety pills. Something cracks through the surface because the body just says, I can't do this, you know. And there's one final episode that puts them over the edge, and I think that's that precipitating event that we've talked about in class.
Yeah, it's all often two or three things down the line. They might have something that happens in their childhood,
right,
and then right after college, and then the what I call piling on.
Right.
The third or fourth event that says, okay, that's enough.
Right.
That's the straw that broke the camel's back.
Right,
and then
right.
They just,
so I'm just saying that piling on begins with the essential wound.
Yeah, you sure? Yeah, that first time, because once someone has a wound, it's always a little bit more sensitive in that spot. They're more sensitive about betrayal or abandonment or whatever it might be.
Right. Well, and for some of us, like some people, when I ask them, you know, when was the first time that you experienced not being safe, some of them really went through their childhood and felt safe, and so it was an experience in a work situation or a situation in a marriage or something, and the intensity was nowhere near what we're talking about when we think about somebody who was really suffering and really at risk, or someone who was just emotionally humiliated or abused or teased or whatever. So, again, there's so many shades of color in this for people, and it what differs is the intensity. And that's what needs to be dealt with. And that's why tapping is, I just love that I have added tapping to the inner child piece, because it's just augmented it and expedited the way that people can move through it. And you're right. I use bundling of baggage almost every day. I just love it.
Yeah, and since I'm in the intensive right now teaching this sort of thing, it's really right up for me. And it's occurring to me, you know, as you're talking, how resilient we are as human beings, and also at the same time how incredibly fragile we are. It doesn't take much to wound us. And it something that you said about, and I forget how you worded it, but you just now talked about it, it's whenever that happens, that essential wound, it could be later in life. To some people, it might not be a big deal. What happens? Sometimes it's a parent gives them the evil eye, a child the evil eye, or a husband says, you know, you're not going to go out wearing that, are you? Or don't you think you should not have that second cupcake or whatever it might be? Some, whatever it is, at some point there's a little crack, and then the next time is a little bit worse. But it's the perception of the person. It may not seem like a big deal to you. I'm sometimes shocked at what somebody describes as a horrific traumatic event that most people would deal with as just no big deal. But how fragile we are. And for some people, those things turn into illnesses, ailments, diseases, pain, syndromes, and for others, it's addictions of some kind.
Right.
It's almost like we're a balloon that has a soft spot in it, a weak spot, and you know, when that balloon gets blown up too much, that part is going to pop at some place. You know, that's going to burst out.
Right. It comes out some way, and it's either in depression or sex addiction or something that is destructive, and yet it pulls us away from the pain.
Yeah, I think that's it. It's I used to have a friend that was doing drugs, a plethora of all kinds of recreational drugs, and he had a T-shirt that said, "Reality is for people who can't deal with drugs." He just thought, why would you want to have to deal with reality when you can go into this other la-la space and just live there all the time? Mm-hmm. And he said, reality sucks. I like that other place. It's safe and nothing bothers me there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that became his norm, so to
yeah,
speak.
Yeah. Well, and for a lot of people, like a lot of people who smoke a lot of dope, you know, it's very easy to do that. And marijuana is a very, very tricky chemical, because the myth is that you can't get addicted to it, and they've shown that that's actually not true. But the reason that it doesn't feel like you can get addicted to it is because it's fat soluble, and so the detox is pretty painless, and so you don't notice it when you're withdrawing from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so most people have the perception, oh, I can just give it up anytime I want, and they're not connecting that the night sweats are connected with it, the nightmares are connected with it. You know, the inability to focus, they're not pinpointing what the real symptoms are, and they're also not seeing the demise of it. You know, like that, remember that old ad where the guy was 40 years old upstairs, you know, and he was still smoking dope and saying something like, yeah, Mom, I'll go out and look for a job today, you know.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think people get addicted to, in pot, they get addicted to the feeling that, you know, being out there in la la land, not having to be
right.
responsible, and you know, that feels good to not have to do anything.
Right.
And get addicted to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could come back to reality, but you go, well, why would I want to? Then when I'm back in reality, I feel guilty that I don't have a job, and I worry about it, and I have shame and regret. I can just smoke a joint and not feel that. Duh.
Right. The problem is their life's not working.
That's right. They don't see it. No, it's not because of the pot. It's because I don't have a job. That has
right.
anything to do with the pot. Yeah, they don't see that correlation.
Right.
Well,
we'll
come up with all kinds of excuses about, I have friends that say, I'm not addicted. I'm not an alcoholic. Well, do you drink every day? Yeah, but I could stop any time.
Yeah.
Have you? Could you? Yeah, sure. Well, why don't you try it? No, I really don't want to. Do you get drunk every night? Oh, yeah, they have all the signs, but they're not an alcoholic. I still go to work the next day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's like having an argument with an adolescent. And working with adolescent addicts is even more of a treat.
Yeah. Well, it's more like having an argument with a 7-year-old sometimes. You know, they have no reasoning.
Hmm.
Well, Catherine, I know you do this thing called interactive tapping, and that was, I think, on the promo for this. So tell us, what the heck is interactive tapping?
Well, that's basically what we just demonstrated. It's when you really focus not so much on the symptom as much as focusing on the relationship. And the purpose of interactive tapping is to really help us realize that all of us have that duality within us. We all have a part of us that wants to expand and get better, and we all have a part of us who's going to act out and try to take the easy way out. And so in the interactive tapping, you're really tapping while you're having that back and forth conversation like you and I did in the mm-hmm. in the demonstration. And again, you're not dealing with symptoms as much as you're dealing with the conversation between the two parts of self, one who's really wounded and wants to act in ways that are not in the best interest of the whole self, and the other one who is really beginning to form a compassionate relationship with the wounded one. So instead of trying to annihilate the addict and, you know, push the addict down, you're befriending it. So interactive tapping is a way to befriend the scared part of you, the cherry saboteur, as I call it, who's acting out, and build a relationship with that part of self so that it's got somebody that's responding to its pain and really seeing it for what it is, beyond the pain, beyond the acting out, to see it in its heroic efforts of just trying to keep us safe.
Yeah, I can really see the value in that, absolutely. So, Catherine, what if someone is dealing with an addiction or a compulsion, what do you think is the most important task or thing for them to do?
Well, I think it's twofold. One is, the first thing that you have to do is develop new ways of coping, because what our addictions do is it begins to deal with our life in ways that prohibit us from developing those natural ways of coping. And so when I was working in treatment, it was really amazing that when people got into treatment, most people went back. I don't care if they were 30, 40, 50, or 60. Most people went back to the emotional coping mechanisms that they had in their teen years or early 20s, because that's often when they began to abuse it and use it as a way to escape reality. Mm-hmm. So they have to be able to develop new coping mechanisms and befriend the process of grief, because the very first experience that an addict is going to have, or someone who's giving up any kind of behavior that they've used as a way to cope with their life, is the anxiety of giving up that behavior. They're going to feel raw. They're going to feel nervous. That's what some of the craving is.
Right.
And so you have to learn a different way of coping, and you have to develop that self-soothing voice that we've already talked about that bridges you into becoming the person that you're really meant to be.
Yep, that's beautiful. That's very profound. And I think while there's a part of people that say, yeah, I should give this up, I should stop smoking, it's not good for my kids to be around it, it's a filthy habit, or drinking or whatever the addiction is, I should. But I need that for release, for my stress, for my anxiety, to distract me from my dad or my crazy wife or whatever it might be. And they don't see that there's an option. And
right.
I can't think of any situation that could come up on the planet just about, including some horrible things like what's happening in Japan and the other parts of the world, but that's about as bad as it can get. You have
an
earthquake, a tsunami, and a nuclear disaster on an island nation. It's just unbelievable. That affects thousands of people. You wouldn't think about turning to drugs or alcohol in those situations. You would be in a survival mode.
Right, right. You know, talking about that, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I got the most beautiful email today from a friend of mine, and she had gotten this letter from a friend of hers in Japan.
Oh, I got that same one.
Wasn't that beautiful? I guess that's going around. But didn't that really make you look at it from a different angle?
Right. Catherine's talking about this lady that was talking about how awful things were. She'd lost everything, and her friends and everybody had lost everything, but they were grateful they were on slightly higher ground and at least weren't being flooded. But how people were sharing what little food and water they had, and if someone had water turned on in their house for a while, people would come over to get some water, take a shower, whatever they could use. If somebody got a hold of some food, they would share it with others. Others would open their door and find that someone had left some tea or rice cakes or something for them that didn't even know who brought it by. Everybody's sharing and helping out each other. No looting or stealing or robbing. Really beautiful self-help and taking care of their village, their family, their friends.
Well, and like you said, they were back to survival, but they were also back to basics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't worrying about getting to work on time. They were worrying about sharing the water with each other. And so I was just really moved by that, and I thought of that when you were just saying that.
Yeah, I was too. But I actually distracted myself, because I was going to say there's almost no disaster in the world, even though something that bad, that can't be helped by tapping. So that's the
true
best coping mechanism I can think of when you're feeling anxious or stressed or feeling a craving coming on, that you simply tap to help
you. I absolutely agree. I think it's a miracle that it is so user-friendly and it's self-administered, and you can use it any time of the day. I really think it is going to change the world and is changing the world.
Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be as common someday as somebody comes over and says, that comes by and says, you want some tea or coffee, some water? Would you like to tap for a couple of minutes? Or you go into the doctor's office and he says, what have you done for your headache? Did you take an aspirin or did you tap for it?
Right. No, I think so, too.
I hope that's the case. Speaking of which, do you have any other little tapping things that we can do so that people pick up?
I'd like to just talk about some of the issues that come up when people are in early recovery and how you can deal with them with tapping. I think your first goal when you're first giving up something is, again, to get that separation between your addict and that part of you who really wants to get better. And what you need to do is really build the bridge with that scared part of you who wants to go out, and you're basically building a relationship. So your goal is to use tapping to create a sense of safety, to create a sense of trust, to really bond with not only the scared part that's going out, but bond with what your commitment is, bond with what your goal is. And you want to learn how to set limits. You know, you're learning how to be a parent to yourself, basically. And so you want to tap on creating a boundary and being able to say no to that addict that's going to take you out. And then you want to deal with the complainer, because nothing's going to take somebody out quicker than the whiner.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I worked with this guy in treatment once, and I mean in group and in one-to-ones, he was just such a drag. And tapping saved us, because I was able to address it. And I said, okay, you've got this whiner in you that's going to really take you back out there. So I think we need to start tapping on him. And by calling it the whiner, but tapping with it and seeing how he was bigger than the whiner part of him,
mm-hmm.
it gave him a way, again, to begin to deal with it. So tapping, again, creates that relationship. And then you want to deal with, or to use tapping on all of the biochemical pieces, because anytime we're operating from any kind of addiction, we have compromised our biochemistry, and it is feeding and cueing us now to work with the addiction. So I use a lot of tapping with building the relationship and partnering with the body. And you do a lot of this too,
mm-hmm.
Lindsay, you know, giving the body permission to let go and instructing the body and just talking to the body as a partner and working with that. And then the other thing I teach a lot in the early days of recovery is some of the coping mechanisms. Like, I teach people how to pray or how to tap while they're saying the Serenity Prayer. Or how to tap while they're saying the Ho'oponopono, forgiveness prayer. Or I have them come up with a one-liner, like my one-liner. When I'm really stressed and I can't even think about doing a setup or even the reminder phrases, and I just need to tap, I have one statement that I say, and it's just, God's love resolves this situation here and now. God's love resolves this situation here and now. And I just say that and tap on each of the points until I return to a state of calm and I can take some action. And what it does is just that simple intervention keeps me from reacting in a way that I'm going to be sorry that I did.
That's right. If nothing else, what we tend to say to ourselves is, oh, God, I can't do this, I can't do this, or
right.
I'll never make through this. What if I fail? What if I screw up? And we're saying those negative things. And I wrote an article last year called Change Your Life by Changing Your Thoughts, and you interrupt those negative things by saying something positive. And I recommend that everybody get themselves a mantra, which is what Kevin
yes.
was just using, something that they can use, and that when they are going, not even just addictions, but anything that you're facing that you can spur of the moment pull out of your pocket and always use, so that you have it memorized. It's short and sweet and powerful for you. It might be something like, and I have them do the same thing, they just start tapping, no setup, just say it, or tap is better, tap and say it, such as, I allow my higher self to survive. I allow my higher self to survive.
Right.
I allow my higher self to survive. Or I choose to get through this easily. I choose to find a way. Or I am powerful, confident, and determined. Some 3, 4, 5 letter word phrase that will help that I call a personal contract statement. It's just a short phrase that has meaning to you. It could be, I choose to do this for my grandmother or somebody that you love, that you, or my child, my son, my daughter, or something that has meaning that's bigger than yourself, that's going to help you. And I think for
right.
addicts, having something like that they can use instead of saying, oh, God, I can't do this, I'm going down, I'm sliding away.
Right, right. And what I say is, all you have to do is intervene in the behavior right then. You just have to stop it right at that point.
All right.
And so you just keep saying that until the feeling subsides. So that's a big one. Another big one that people really need to deal with in recovery, and this is whenever we're learning a new behavior, is we get to a place where we get cocky.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've spent like 3 or 4 weeks really, really, you know, working on this new way of being. And then we get cocky and we think we can loosen up. And most often what happens is once we begin to kind of let down and we just extend it a little bit, then we can go back out there. So people really need to define what it is that they're committing to and then watch where they start getting squirrely.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And at a certain point, with an addiction, it's really kind of all or nothing. But with some of the allergies and stuff, you can get to a place where you've neutralized it enough where you can reintroduce your, you know, body to it. But you just have to be real careful with how you do that and do it from a place of being centered. You know, there's a different energy when we're being cocky and overconfident. That's the addict in charge. When we're being centered and we're really making a choice, it comes from a different place, a different feeling place in our body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Charlie Sheen says, well, you don't use crack cocaine at all unless you think you can do it socially responsible, unless you can be socially responsible about it. I go, oh, that's a good place for an addict to come from. How's it working for you, Charlie?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely, the know-it-all, the little attorney.
Well, Catherine, I want to make sure before we finish that you have time to explain this program that you've come up with, this 30-day recovery process that you use. So tell the listeners about that.
Well, there's a very sweet story that goes with that, actually. And I was working with this good friend of mine when I was back taking care of Mom, and I had come home, and then I was going to come back, and she and I were going to start this 30-day program, right? And what happened instead is that Mom fell, and then I got all involved in the end-of-life crisis with her. So what I did is I had just come back from California last July, and on the very same date that Carol and I would have started this 30-day program, I started what I call my 30-day program, and what it is it's an email that has a link to an 8 to 10-minute YouTube video that really addresses a variety of different issues, like the safety, the trust, the cockiness. It's got one where I show people how to dance and tap, and it really addresses different issues that you confront in early recovery, and it gets the person that's new to recovery very comfortable with tapping and very comfortable with dealing with that addict.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of call it the 30-day program. It's basically $1 a day. You know, they sign up, and for $30 you start getting this email campaign. And I designed it so that it could be used by somebody who was giving up an addiction, a really hardcore addiction in that 30-day treatment center, or someone who was working with a compulsion, and I define a compulsion different than an addiction,
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't have the biochemical piece, or someone who was just starting a goal and wanted 30 days of commitment, and you're dealing with showing up 24 hours at a time and walking yourself through these different facets of sabotage. So the umbrella of the program is to really teach people to get comfortable with dealing with those two parts of them,
mm-hmm.
to get comfortable with the tapping. So it's great with people who are new to tapping and wanting to do a goal, and to learn the self-soothing language and to make a commitment every 24 hours. I end every video, all you got to do is make it until tomorrow.
I like that. That's really good. Those steps, if I understand you right, one is to separate the basic four elements I'm hearing, separate between the addict and the part of within you. The second step, dealing with the body repairing and reconnection.
Right.
And then third, developing coping mechanisms, of which tapping can be a big part of.
Right.
And then preparing the client for a change in structure.
Right. Well, all of us can make a 30-day commitment to something, but then we get really nervous when we're going to be off of that protocol.
Yeah.
Okay, now how do I get back to my regular life?
Yeah.
And so this whole program has tapping is the key to it. Tapping is done in every day's video. So I talk a little bit about what the focus is that day, and then I lead them through the tapping. And it's got a video, but it's also got an audio version of it. and so they can get the MP3 and take that with them. Or so I've really made it very accessible. And usually I just actually make this available when somebody's doing one of my packages, because I'll do 3 or 5 or 10 hour packages. And so we'll do our first session. We'll do the bundling of baggage of the issue and get the focus. And then I register them, and they start getting the email campaign. And then we do our other sessions somewhere in that 30 days whenever they feel they need that extra support.
Oh, I like that. I like the simplicity of it, and I like that it's a short, you know, 8-minute video. I think that's good. That's anybody can find that much time to take care of themselves during the day.
Absolutely. That's the feedback I got from people, too.
Yeah.
It was something that I knew was going to be there waiting for me. It was short. It wasn't a big commitment, you know, and it was fun.
That's good. Kevin, I notice you're like me. You name things. I think that's a good thing to do. You name something the attic within. What do you call the good side within, the other part that wants to be sober? What do you call that?
Well, I have a number of names, but my favorite name is the illuminated adult.
Illuminated adult. Yeah, I like that. I like the hero within, being your own hero. But
yeah, I like the shero, if you want to.
Shero, that's good, yeah. I think it's good to address, we all have that, there's that little angel part on one shoulder,
yeah,
and then we have that little devil that gets us, you know, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have both of those parts. And when you can get the little shero, hero, angel part winning most of the time, then the battle is pretty much licked, because it feels so good when you are living the life of your dreams and honoring yourself, your health, and your commitment, and your family, that itself becomes the good kind of addiction, and you just want more of that. You know, our purpose in life, as I've always said, is to feel good. And so you get some of that, and you go, gee, I want more. The downside is that that's what people get from their addictions. They do it, it feels good, so they want more of that, not seeing that they can have that feeling without the substance, without the chemical and stuff that's so bad for us.
Right. Well, and the nice thing, and it does get addictive in a sense, because the better you feel, the more you want to feel that way, and the tools that you use to feel that way, you then begin to use that. And I think that's why tapping catches on so much for people, is because it's quick and it's so effective, and it's empowering and it's user-friendly.
Well, Catherine, this has been just great. We are out of time. It went very quickly. You've been a doll and given us just a ton of good information. So I want to make sure I get your website in again. It's www.joincatherinetaylor.com, and that's CATHRYN, Taylor, spelled the traditional way, .com. JoinCatherineTaylor.com and read about her 30-day program and how to get sessions with her and everything. So, Catherine, thank you for an enlightening and entertaining and a very valuable session tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and it's been most enjoyable.
Thanks. And thanks, everybody, for joining us. Bye-bye.
Join us again every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, as Lindsay has conversations with the top talent in the world of energy psychology. Our intention is to help you tap away your challenges and tap into physical and emotional freedom. Find replays of these shows on the media page at proeft.com. And again, thank you for joining us.